All right. Everyone, we're coming up to our last case. That's exciting, isn't it? Okay, 12-2632, Taylor versus Browns, and it's Ms. Miza.
Miza, thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. This case presents a clear-cut, well-understood example of a violation of Kyler versus Sullivan. Actually, the facts in this case that make out the Sullivan violation are not in dispute. Raymond Prusak jointly represented the co-defendants Lavelle and Lowell Taylor at their simultaneous but severed trials for murder, and he presented a joint defense on their behalf. But he pulled his punches at Lavelle's trial. He refrained from calling three eyewitnesses who would have negated Lavelle's accountability for the shooting entirely by testifying that he didn't pass his gun to pass the gun to his brother Lowell, but yet those witnesses would have implicated Prusak's other client, Lowell Taylor, by testifying that they implicated that they saw Lowell shoot the decedent.
Okay, well, here's what we've got.
Okay.
We've got the state trying to establish guilt beyond a reasonable doubt based on the testimony of a single witness. How would it have helped Lavelle to put on three witnesses that would present inconsistent testimony as to where he was at the time of shooting, some of which would corroborate the government witness's testimony as to his whereabouts? I mean, isn't a reasonable application of the facts to the case for the state court to determine that Mr. Prusak's decision was based entirely on what would maximize Lavelle's chance of acquittal and not on any consideration of Lowell?
Actually, it's an incorrect and unreasonable reading of the record to find that these three witnesses were inconsistent in any way. And I'd like to clarify that. The Illinois Supreme Court made, under D2, unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the complete record. So the three witnesses, Bingham, Plummer, and Woods, all would have testified, and this is not in dispute, that they were at the shooting, that they did not see Lavelle passing the gun. They were not inconsistent about where Lavelle was at the time of the shooting. Bingham, Plummer, and Woods both would have said that Lavelle was not at the fight, and Bingham never testified at the post-conviction evidentiary hearing about where Lavelle was during the fight. So there's nothing inconsistent about that. They all consistently would have said that Lavelle didn't hand him the gun. And in fact, two of the witnesses at least, Bingham and Plummer, gave prior consistent statements to the police in which they said they saw Lowell shoot the decedent. They did not tell the police that Lavelle handed him the gun. So the Illinois Supreme Court's reading of the record is arbitrary and unreasonable. They actually didn't cite certain facts that I just cited about the prior consistent statements to the police. And they also omitted, they said that two of the witnesses, Bingham and Plummer, never told the police that Lavelle didn't hand them the gun. Well, there's no reason why these two witnesses would have told the police that. Bingham testified, Plummer testified, he didn't even know Lavelle was under arrest. Why would you tell the police that someone didn't hand someone a gun if you didn't even know he was under arrest?
You know what else sort of bothered me, and you can help me? Prusak rested Lowell's case first. So how could the conflict have influenced his decision, given that he could have produced the witnesses in Lavelle's case after Lowell's case had already gone?
He could not have produced those witnesses in Lavelle's case, even after he rested Lowell's case, because to do so, he would be compromising his duty of loyalty to Lowell. And that is because the trials were, although severed, they were tried simultaneously. The severance here was actually an illusion.
Uh-huh.
The trials went exactly forward. Prusak made an opening statement for Lowell in front of his jury. He didn't even make an opening statement for Lavelle. He adopted the cross-examination he made for Lowell's case, for Lavelle's case, especially with respect to the main eyewitness against Lavelle. And then when Lowell's jury was out, Prusak rested his case. Well, if Lavelle had, first of all, in Illinois, of course, you have to, in discovery, announce your witnesses. before trial. So he would have had to announce these three witnesses before trial. They would have instantly been made available again for the state against Lowell. There is no way on this record that Prusak could have presented those three witnesses without compromising his duty of loyalty to Lowell. In fact, what this record shows is that Prusak was making every effort to hide the conflict in his struggle to serve two masters.
Let me ask you this. Did Lowell and Lowell ever sign waivers about the potential conflict of interest?
No, they didn't. And the record shows that when the witnesses all came to Prusak's office and said that and Lovell was with them, said they'd be willing to testify because they saw Lovell didn't hand Lowell the gun. According to the witnesses, Prusak said, "I can't present you because you would hurt Lowell's case." Now, Prusak denies having said that to the witnesses, but I don't think that means anything as far as the Sullivan claim is concerned. He never explained to them what a conflict of interest is. And, of course, during the trial, it never became apparent to the trial judge. The trial judge had no obligation under Holloway to inquire about the conflict.
If I could, and didn't, is that not standard practice in Illinois trial courts kind of problem?
It is not standard practice, in fact, in Illinois for trial courts to inquire about a potential conflict when one attorney represents co-defendants.
Well, let me, if I could, address a big concern of mine, Ms. Miza. I agree that you've got an actual conflict established here, but I don't agree with you to the extent you're saying you don't need some separate proof of an adverse effect.
That's actually not my argument.
Okay.
I understand I need a proof of adverse effect.
Okay. Maybe I misunderstood your argument then. But where I'm concerned is where we get into kind of gray, deferential, ADEPA territory here. And let's suppose the family brings in just one witness who's ready to tell this story. Lovell was across the street. He wasn't involved. But I did see Lowell shoot the victim, Mr. Baker, and sounds like a great witness, except that this witness has got three prior perjury convictions and has already told the grand jury and the police three different versions of things here, so that essentially even a fully independent lawyer would say, I just can't put this guy on.
Well, there's a, you know, I believe that if a witness comes, when the witness comes, and even under your scenario about, you know, he's got perjury convictions and so forth, first of all, if he is describing a scenario that would help one client or potentially present testimony helping one client but hurting the other, then at that point the lawyer is under a conflict of interest.
I agree. There's an actual conflict there.
And that
but
he
in
shouldn't
terms
even
of
be making the decision.
Right. But in terms of an adverse effect, take the standard that we applied in Griffin, okay? In essence, in that situation, we don't defer to the lawyer who's acting under a conflict, but we do ask, in some way, what would an independent lawyer do about
this? And you should ask that question and look at what the witnesses would say. In this case, these were great witnesses. You know, the Illinois, and I'm saying Illinois Supreme Court's opinion is totally an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the record. They had bad backgrounds. One witness had only one prior conviction. Other convictions he incurred after the trial in this case. All of the state's witnesses had prior backgrounds. They all had criminal records. As I explained before, all of the witnesses were consistent about their testimony about where Lovell was and what they saw Lowell do. There was no downside to presenting this evidence. Furthermore, the state's evidence, as Prusak said, the state had a weak case. They had one eyewitness who didn't even identify Lovell. First of all, didn't tell the police at the scene that they saw someone hand Lowell the gun. Didn't say anything to the police until they were at the police station, and he happened to see Lovell walking by and said, "Oh yeah, that guy handed the gun to the shooter." So the state's case was really weak. There is no downside to presenting at least one of these three witnesses, if not all three. So in my opinion, this record shows even a fully independent conflict-free lawyer would have presented these witnesses. But Prusak shouldn't have been the one to make that decision in this case.
Thank you. Mr. Levin?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Eric Levin on behalf of the appellee, Warden Grounds. I'd like to begin with the question that you asked Judge Hamilton, and because I think I agree with you with one slight caveat. There definitely was a conflict of interest here. But in the language of Kyler and Mickens, there wasn't an actual conflict of interest. Those cases pointed out, but and Mickens especially stressed that when the Court used the term actual conflict of interest, what it meant was a conflict of interest that actually affected the lawyer's performance. So it's not necessarily that there's two separate inquiries, whether there's an actual conflict plus adverse effect. What the Court was saying is that an actual conflict of interest itself is a conflict of interest that does actually affect the lawyer's performance. So this might just be a semantic point, but I agree with you that the main issue here is, did the petitioner establish a link between the conflict of interest and the lawyer's performance? And that's the clearly established law that the Supreme Court's articulated in both Kyler and Mickens. And I think my opposing counsel here made clear just now that the petitioner's argument is that merely by not presenting these witnesses, or merely by not presenting a plausible defense that would have been inconsistent with another client's interests, that automatically amounts to an adverse effect. And I think both Kyler and Mickens are clear that that's not the clearly established law.
But that's sufficient to create an actual conflict, right?
We might be quibbling over semantics, but I think it creates a conflict. But
let me ask it this way. Can we or the Illinois courts give any deference at all to Mr. Prusak's decision, his judgment not to call these witnesses?
I don't think it's a matter of giving deference to Mr. Prusak, and I don't think that's what the Illinois Supreme Court did, and I think the district court made this point. What the Illinois courts did is independently look at the records. Sure, they framed the inquiry in terms of what Mr. Prusak stated were his reasons for not calling the witnesses, but the state courts then independently looked at the record and found that those were valid, legitimate, non-conflict-related reasons. And I think you actually made a good point when you said, and I think an interesting way to look at this is to sort of pose the counterfactual. If Mr. Prusak did not represent Lowell, would he have done anything differently in this case? And I think the entire record looked at as a whole demonstrates that he wouldn't have.
Well, who's making that finding? And you've gotten to the heart of things here, as far as I'm concerned, because the Illinois Supreme Court seems to be deferring to state court factual findings that I can't find in the record. Mm-hmm. Never made those findings about what independent counsel would have done.
Well, I think 2 points to that. The first is that it's true that the trial court didn't explicitly make factual findings.
Right,
and
exactly.
And petitioner raised that issue before the Illinois Supreme Court, and the Illinois Supreme Court said that the state court necessarily or implicitly made factual findings by its very decision.
Forgive me for interrupting, but no credibility findings. How can it be reasonable for the Illinois Supreme Court to assume that the court found Prusak credible based solely on a legal conclusion?
Well, I think for purposes of federal habeas, the court's been clear in Mendiola versus Schomig that we cite in our brief that 2254E1, the provision that requires federal habeas courts to defer to state court factual findings, applies whether or not it was the state trial court or a state appellate court that made factual findings. So at the very least, the Illinois Supreme Court's review of the record and its own factual findings are entitled to deference on federal habeas review.
Whole case turns on whether Prusak is credible as his thought process is.
Well, I don't.
In deciding not to call those witnesses, and we don't have any credibility.
I don't think it necessarily turns entirely on Prusak's credibility. To an extent, it does, but the important question is, does the record, both the trial record and the evidentiary hearing record, support Prusak? So when Prusak says, I didn't call these witnesses because they made a horrible impression on me, They had about, I think, 11 felonies between them. They were friends with the petitioner. They were fellow gang members, not to mention the fact that there were inconsistencies between what they were saying and what petitioner told me. And when he then when he says that I made a strategic decision to challenge the state's case on reasonable doubt grounds,
But that deserves no deference, right? He's acting under an actual conflict of interest that is as stark as can be imagined.
Certainly, it doesn't require any sort of blind deference. And I would agree with you if the court had simply said, Prusak said there was no conflict, that's the end of it. That would have been unreasonable. But that's not what the courts did. The courts independently looked at the record. They looked at the testimony at trial. They looked at the evidentiary hearing testimony. And they said the record supports what Prusak said. The reasons that Prusak gave us for why he did what he did actually fit with the record. And a non-conflicted lawyer in that position, or even Prusak in that position, had he not represented Lowell, would have made exactly the same decision that he did here.
Prusak was already suspended from practicing law for violating the conflict of interest rules during the pendency of the Illinois Supreme Court's decision, right?
That's, as far as I'm aware, that's true, yes,
and
Your Honor.
And the court still credited his testimony on compliance with the conflict rules.
That's true, but again, I think the reason they credited it was because it fit with the record. Prusak here, as he explained, had a relatively weak case. The state had a relatively weak case. One eyewitness who himself had credibility problems.
As counsel pointed out, she said really the witnesses that the state called had the same kind of background as the witnesses it could have been. Also, she suggested they really didn't have that number of convictions.
I think the record's clear they had about 11 convictions between them, the petitioner's proposed witnesses. And I agree that the state's witnesses exhibited some of the same weaknesses, and that's precisely the reason why, if counsel decides to vigorously attack those witnesses, impugn their credibility, bring up the fact that they've got prior convictions, gang affiliations, et cetera, and hold the state to its burden of beyond a reasonable doubt, it would actually weaken the case to then put on your own witnesses who are going to be undermined. You lose credibility with the fact finder. This is a decision that a reasonable lawyer could make. And so,
let me ask you, what evidence other than Baker's testimony to the police is there to show that Lowell ever gave Lowell the gun?
Baker was the only witness. And that, I think, fits, though, with that. That essentially demonstrates that it was a reasonable strategy to pursue, to attack the state's witnesses, argue that the evidence here was insufficient, and not essentially muddy up that case or undermine your own credibility by putting on witnesses that the fact finder, the judge in this case, is very likely to not believe. It would have undermined the case rather than helped the case. And that's precisely, that shows precisely that it wasn't Prusak's duties to Lowell that prevented him from calling these witnesses. It was his duties to Lavelle. He was looking out for Lavelle's interests when he decided not to present these witnesses.
Let me ask you, Mr. Levin. This is right at the end of the Illinois Supreme Court's opinion. The circuit court found as more credible Prusak's testimony that his decision not to call defendants proffered witnesses was not attributable to any alleged conflict of interest, but rather was based on trial strategy and tactics and Prusak's professional judgment. I think I've got three problems with that sentence. Okay. One is, where do I find the circuit court's credibility finding? Second, doesn't that seem to give credence to Prusak's professional judgment rather than applying the independent standard that has got to apply here? I'll stick with those two for now.
Okay, and I'd like to address both of them. Mm-hmm. I think, first of all, I absolutely agree with you. There were no explicit factual findings, but the Illinois Supreme Court made the finding that there were implicit factual findings, and it deferred to those. And to that extent, it itself might have made factual findings, or it deferred to what it found were the factual findings. But
We know it can make appellate findings of fact, and we're supposed to defer to them. But if the state courts are doing a kind of Alphonse and Gaston routine, after we're going to defer to you, no, we're deferring to you, there is no trial court finding, but the Supreme Court is deferring to those non-existent findings. That seems kind of unreasonable.
Well, but just as I said that the courts didn't blindly defer to Prusak, I don't think the Illinois Supreme Court just blindly deferred to the trial court. It didn't say the trial court made that finding and that's it. It looked at the record and found that that finding, whether it made it explicitly or implicitly, was supported by the record. And I think that's
one,
the finding.
One
that
could find that. I'll give you that. One could find that. The question is whether anybody did who actually heard the witness. So.
Well, again, I think the courts did. And I think definitely when you look at the opinions together, there was a state court factual finding. Not necessarily that or not simply that Prusak's, the reason Prusak gave was his actual reason, but even further than that, that the reason he gave was a legitimate, reasonable trial strategy supported by the record. And so that when the court asks itself, hypothetically, would Prusak have made that decision had he not had the conflict? And when the court says that, yes, he would have made the exact same decision, essentially what the court's saying is that Lavelle has not shown that the conflict of interest, which we agree existed, he has not shown that that conflict of interest actually affected his lawyer's performance. He hasn't demonstrated that link. And it's that link, when Kyler and Mickens tell us that where a petitioner demonstrates a link between his between the actions of counsel that he challenges and a conflict of interest, when there's that link there, it justifies us not requiring him to go through the regular Strickland procedure where you have to demonstrate both constitutionally deficient performance and prejudice. But it's only when that link is present that essentially the Kyler rule is justified. And that's the clearly established Supreme Court law.
Well, the clearly established Supreme Court law is that we presume prejudice. It's not irrebuttable. And that's clear both in Sullivan and Strickland discussing.
Well, I don't think Kyler or Mickens make any room for the presumption to rebut it. It's essentially a per se prejudice. If the petitioner shows that his trial lawyer's performance was actually affected by a conflict, that's the end of the matter. There's no
maybe
there's no
we're quibbling, but I thought it was pretty clear that the Supreme Court had said it's reasonable for the criminal justice system to maintain a fairly rigid rule of presumed prejudice for conflicts of interest. It's not quite the per se rule of prejudice that exists for Sixth Amendment. That's in, from Strickland, talking about conflicts.
And I'll have to concede there that I was mistaken. But I don't think that changes the fact, though, that whether it's a presumed prejudice standard that can be rebutted or a per se prejudice standard, in either case, it depends on the antecedent question of whether there was actually a link between the conflict and counsel's performance. In the language of Kyler and Mickens, whether the conflict of interest actually affected the lawyer's performance. And so the fact that the Illinois Supreme Court didn't apply this inherent conflict rule that the petitioner's arguing for can't form the basis for federal habeas relief, because that rule simply was not clearly established at the time the Illinois Supreme Court made its decision or even to this day. If there are no further questions, I'd ask the court to affirm the district court's judgment denying habeas relief.
Thanks, Mr. Levin. Thank you.
Thank you.
Liza, that's okay.
There are any questions?
There's the court.
I have a question.
Okay.
You want to speak to those witnesses that would have testified that went to the lawyer's office because counsel is
Bingham, Plummer, and Woods.
They all had terrible backgrounds. And
yeah,
and,
you know, he mentioned 11 prior convictions. Mm-hmm. As to one of the witnesses, I'm not sure if it's Bingham or Plummer, but he actually only had one prior at the time. That would have been at the time of Lavelle's trial. He incurred other ones at the time of the post-conviction evidentiary hearing. Keith Baker, by the way, the state's witness, he had at least three prior convictions, two for gun violations, and he actually lied about them on the witness stand. He said he'd never touched a gun before, and one good thing that Prusak did at this trial was he impeached Baker, and Baker admitted, oh, yeah, I do have two priors for UUW. All the witnesses were tainted in that way. But it doesn't seem to me there's any downside. I don't understand, actually, the respondent's argument with it would have hurt Lavelle's case to present these witnesses. They all would have testified consistently to not seeing Lavelle hand Lowell the gun. And that's how he was found. That's how he was found guilty, and that's the only theory upon which he was found guilty.
And then in terms of laying out the inconsistencies that he claimed, that the lawyer that Prusak claimed were made, were those ever spelled out?
No, they're non-existent. They are non-existent, and Prusak never spelled them out. And that's the other thing about his testimony. It's so vague and ambiguous. All he said was, oh, the witnesses were inconsistent. One would have put Lavelle at one place, one would have put Lavelle at the other place. They wouldn't have. I mean, they all would have said he didn't hand him the gun. And there's, you know,
no,
so Prusak never
said
that.
They would have said, we didn't see him hand.
So they were not inconsistent. So
I'm just looking at what his testimony.
But his and then he said they made a bad impression on me. They had bad backgrounds. He never explained that. He was testifying 7 years.
That was the court leaped on the conclusions that he made, and
he testified.
They were making credibility findings about him and his character because they believed his conclusions about the witness.
Right. I mean, he testified 7 years after the trial. He had lost his notes because there had been a flood in his office, so he didn't even have any, he hardly had a memory of the trial.
If your position is right in this case, Ms. Miza, should a trial court ever allow joint representation in a criminal case?
Oh, sure. I mean, it could happen. But first of all, as I noted before, in Illinois, there's no requirement that the judge inquire. Mm-hmm. But if the defendants don't have inconsistent defenses,
if you're the trial judge, or the prosecutor, you have no idea whether any witness like this might pop up and
that's
poison
the evil of joint representation.
So, wouldn't you, as a trial judge, in the wake of this experience, say, I'm just not going to allow this? I don't care how much you waive.
They could, but in Cook County, it's not done that way. But I do believe the public defenders never represent co-defendants.
Right.
Yep.
But this was a private attorney.
Yeah, and that's still the practice today in Cook County.
You know, we can't force people to not agree in federal court to have joint representation. I mean, you can question them from here till next year and tell them the evil and... And then, of course, that's what it's appealed on.
Either way.
Even though they said, no, we waive that right. No, we don't. Yeah, we'll sign it. We want her. We want her. We want her. And then, of course, that's where the appeal comes. All right. Anything? If you have another, okay.
Thank you.
Well, gosh, thanks, everyone. And the case is going to be taken under advisement. And wasn't it an interesting day? All right. Okay. This court will be in recess until for a while, actually. We're going into our
April Fool's Day.
Our recess. Goodbye, everyone. Thank you.